This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. David Granite, and welcome to Health Matters. The story that you're about to hear is a story of how medicine actually happens, about how science is applied to the human body, and about how knowledge is transmitted to the general population. It's a fascinating story, and it's one that really has great importance to you, to me, to everyone, because it tells you a lot about how medicine moves forward and sometimes backwards in the United States of America. To get us through this story, we have the author of the new book, Silicone on Trial, Dr. Jack Fisher. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Fisher is Emeritus Professor of Surgery here from the UC San Diego Health System, where he is sort of an icon and one of the more important people in the history here at UC San Diego. And I'm so thrilled that you're going to spend a couple of minutes with us talking about
this.
Good
to be here.
You know, this is an amazing story about what happened with silicone breast implants and the whole story about silicone and medical use and how it was dealt with. But in some ways, it's the story of a lot of things that happen in medicine and a lot of misinformation and about how our society works. So I'm so excited that we're having a chance to talk about this. If I have it right, the first trial that was ever held, somebody won $1.7 million because the breast implant caused them a disease. And by the time we were done, some billions, $12 billion changed hands.
$15, $16 billion.
Going to trial lawyers. So this is an expensive story as well.
Right.
Silicone was invented or first discovered in the late 1800s.
First polymerized in the 1890s by a British chemist.
And then we kind of forget about it. It doesn't do much until World War II?
1930s, a chemist at Corning Glass sort of rediscovered, refined it. And then as the war began, very important applications for silicone were discovered, lubricants at very high altitude.
And so that's in airplanes that made them actually be able to function.
Hyman Rickover of the Submarine Service discovered it and first applied it to submarines going at exceptional depth, but it was soon applied for a number of the important planes that helped us win the war.
You know, before we go too far, I want to make sure that we do something right off the bat. Silicon, silicone.
As different as can be.
They sound
silicon
so much alike.
I know. Silicon is an element, one of the chemical elements. If you mix it with oxygen, you've got silicone dioxide, which is everyday sand, granite. Silicone dioxide is the most common compound, solid compound on the planet. But if you polymerize, meaning you make chains out of silicone dioxide and attach things to it, now it's a polymer. Now it's completely different. And the original chemist combined the words silicon and ketone and came up with silicone. But it's confused all the time in the press.
And that leads to some of the confusion that we're going to talk about along the way because of this automatic belief that silicone would cause disease because silicon could. In part.
Correct.
Okay. So we're using this this new chain that's developed in the late 1900s, late to 1800s. It gets used in World War II as a lubricant. When does it start first getting used in medical
use? First medical use was actually as a lubricant, quite accidental. Penicillin, a miracle drug, was first coming into combat use. Syringes for administering medicines were lubricated with paraffin. They were glass and they broke all the time. So somebody heard about an amazing lubricant, got it from the aviation mechanics, and started lubricating syringes.
So this is the inside of the syringe.
Yes.
There's a rubber plunger that goes down, and for that to slide, you have
more
that,
easily.
That means every time that you do an injection, so a little bit of silicone might be going into the body.
Microdroplet. But it adds up, say, in a diabetic who takes insulin every day.
So they've been. If you're a diabetic, you've been getting exposed to silicone
since the late 1940s.
Right. Any consequence to that to those diabetics?
Well, none that's known. But you see, the toxicity of silicone was examined right after the war. late 40s, the definitive study, 1948, showing that silicone was amazingly biocompatible, compatible with human tissues. Still is. Those studies were largely ignored by the FDA, unfortunately.
Yeah, and so we fast forward, and for purposes of both cosmetic use and reconstructive use, silicone is a really neat substance for breast reconstruction.
It is. It's unique in that the gel format was developed specifically for the breast implant. But years before that, little solid pieces of silicone were used as implants for deformities of the face, some of them post-war deformities.
With no consequences.
No
right.
consequences.
So what happens to change our idea about this product that is so valuable and used in so many different aspects of medicine? Now we have breast implants, and then something changes.
In the 1980s, concerns are expressed about whether or not breast cancer might be influenced, whether it would be more frequent in a woman with breast implants. Somebody speaking for Public Citizen predicted an epidemic based on no data whatsoever. Fortunately, there was a plastic surgeon and epidemiologist who in the late 70s began a study to determine whether there was an increase in breast cancer. There was none, but that did not stop the scare.
Okay, so, but it's not just breast cancer that gets to be the scare, it's rheumatologic disease.
Soon after that, people with joint pains, unexplained joint pains and a lot of other symptoms, they're also beginning to wonder whether it is because of the breast implants. People jump to conclusions. There are case reports. People say, well, because these two things are happening together, they have to be causative. But association is not causation.
Well, and here comes our science literacy, because you and I were talking about this before the show, is that understanding that association is not causative is something that everybody learns in medical school when you go to become a doctor. I remember I went to Yale, and in our biostatistics class, they showed us that the number of Mercedes in a population was coincident with the number of heart attacks. But the number of Mercedes didn't cause the heart attacks. They're associated. And it was one of those moments you go, ah. And so you were involved, though, with the first case reports that were published.
Yes.
And the question of whether or not to even publish them because they weren't causative.
I reviewed for the editor of one of the rheumatism journals who was on our faculty here, just a case report, and there was great dilemma about whether to publish it or not. It was published just to see if it would elicit more reports. It elicited a huge number of reports. But when it was published, I think that there was belief that it might be coincidental, but it took more time to find out that it was coincidental and not causative. Classic example about the difference between causation and association is, would you agree with me that fire engines are associated with fires? But
yes.
I think we can all agree that fire engines do not
cause fires. Yes. Well, and this is really important. And plus, there are two things that happen in a population. People get breast implants. People get rheumatologic diseases. Some of the people who get rheumatologic diseases may have breast implants. So there will be an overlap. And we publish those, and then we start counting how many occur. And that's what we call a numerator. But then we have to divide it by how many were actually implanted in these cases. And without both of those numbers, you can never know if it's causative.
Correct. Newspapers are reporting all the time scares and health stories in which they have a numerator, but they forget the denominator. And if you don't have both, you don't have a fraction, you don't have any idea how frequently something happens.
And this comes up when you start talking about in your book and in some of the history that you talk about is, not only do people start noticing this and stories start happening, it goes to court, where it's probably the wrong place to adjudicate science, but it goes to court and then the FDA gets involved.
Well, or the other way around. Now, while it is true that there were isolated cases in which people took Dow Corning, the first manufacturer of silicone medical devices, to court, it wasn't until the FDA expressed their own doubts and concerns about the safety of silicone, ignoring prior research, by the way, that then that activated the trial lawyers, and there was just a blossoming of lawsuits.
And those lawsuits eventually wipe out Dow Corning.
Yes. It sends them into bankruptcy protection. It does not destroy the company, and they've come out of bankruptcy.
Sure.
They're still a very, very pioneering
firm. And this represented about 1% of their business at the time, and it bankrupted them.
Breast implants was never more than 1% of their business because they're the largest supplier of silicone for electronics and all sorts of industries use silicone.
So what happens at the FDA? We think of the FDA as this august agency. I'm always stunned that most people don't know that the FDA doesn't do its own studies, that drug companies, for example, study it and then present the data to the FDA. Why does the FDA get involved and why does it go so wrong?
As you know, when I retired, I went back to school and studied history, a long love of mine. In particular, I studied regulatory history, which really begins at the beginning of the 19th century for our American culture. And what I was surprised to learn, but it doesn't surprise anybody who knows about regulation, is that regulation is a political process. It is not a scientific process, even when the product in question is based on technology. So I think that throughout the whole chaotic interaction over breast implants, we were dealing with a political position, not a scientific position, because there was plenty of science to show that silicone was safe for medical use.
And I started the show by talking about the medical uses and all the studies that showed it was safe, because that chronologically came first before all this happened. And so they knew all that before they started making these pronouncements. And when you have a political process, you also have personalities.
Yes.
The person matters. In science, you hope the science speaks. In the political process, the person speaks. And the person who was in charge of the FDA at the time spoke.
Well, in science, you have to use all the evidence before you can weigh your conclusion. Not so in law. Law, you use the evidence that supports your client. And unfortunately, in government, you sometimes select the evidence for what a preconceived conclusion
The FDA put together a commission. It had some people, some doctors, to try and get information and heard testimony, some from here at UC San Diego.
The FDA has no jurisdiction over the medical profession, but legislation in the soon after World War II created advisory committees. So the FDA, by law, has to listen to advisory committees, but they don't have to agree with them. And they don't even have to answer them if they don't want to. There's an enormous amount of power in our regulatory agencies, especially the FDA.
One of the stories that I heard you tell was that at the end of one of those advisories, one of the doctors, when asked what his opinion was, after listening to all the testimony, said, well, if this is the number of cases that we're talking about, then breast implants are preventing disease, not causing it, because it was so few comparatively what you would expect in the normal population.
Rheumatoid arthritis is the most common rheumatic disease. And yet, for some reason, there were very few case reports of rheumatoid arthritis and breast implants, whereas there were cases of breast implants and much rarer diseases. And that led him to tentatively suggest that the implants protected from rheumatoid arthritis. But what he really meant to say was, you're dealing with an entirely biased population of people. You can't make conclusions from a bunch of case reports.
And so how did this all go wrong? Well, I mean, why did it go so wrong so badly? The theory, people who were taken advantage of to feel like they had done something wrong by having a breast implant, the emotions of it. What really went wrong in this process?
It's hard to pinpoint a single item. I think that the decisive moment was when then-Commissioner David Kessler decided that he would go with the legal evidence rather than the medical evidence, even though he reversed that position very soon after. But it's not just one individual. I mean, to this day, there are only three companies that have been allowed to market a full line of silicone medical products. That's more companies than in several countries in Europe. And that's only after decades of review before approval has been achieved. So the bias is still there. The FDA still lists connective tissue disease as a potential, or that's a synonym for rheumatic diseases, still lists it as a potential complication, even though countless studies have shown that there is no causal relationship.
And when they first restricted the use, they didn't say, go in and take the ones that are there out. So they allowed the silicone breast implants to stay in women who had gotten them, at the same time as they were saying, we're going to restrict their use going forward.
They called for a temporary moratorium, and it lasted about 2 or 3 months. It was a shockwave through the industry, through plastic surgical practices, and, of course, it energized the trial lawyers. But they never thought, or they never decided that they should come out. And, of course, that didn't make any sense either. It also didn't make any sense that about the same time that they were giving breast implants so much criticism, they were approving silicone liquid for use in your specialty, weren't they?
Yeah, in the eye. And it was almost exactly at the same era. I mean, within
yes.
with
at early the same 90s, time. About the same time.
Yeah, so they're approving it for use in the eye. And by the way, that's a liquid, not encapsulated in a bag in any way. It is available to the body when you inject it into the eye. Whereas the silicone gel was at least theoretically encapsulated in some bag.
But still the same chemical polymer.
Yes.
And at the same time, everybody is still getting just tiny amounts of silicone in their intravenous tubing and their syringes. We never could understand why the FDA focused on one application of silicone and ignored thousands of others. It made no sense. Therefore, it was political, not scientific.
And along with political, there's another group that played a role in this. I mean, obviously, trial lawyers had an opportunity to make hay, if you will, out of all this. And then there's another group, the media.
Reporters struggle to get their editors to give them space in a newspaper. Good news doesn't sell. You hear that. Oh, I heard that over and over again when I interviewed reporters who covered this topic. Scare stories sell. And every morning, almost, when we wake up and see the newspapers, there's a new scare story, usually based on association, not causation, because nobody knows. So, yes, the media had a tremendous impact on how this progressed, because breast implants capture attention. And remember, there were people who were hurting, were suffering. There are local complications to breast implants. There's no disease caused by them, but there are local problems that can occur, complications that were known from the beginning of their use. So that can create a lot of media attention.
And I think at least one reporter said, despite the outcome that we now know that silicone breast implants are safe, said it was still the most important story she ever covered.
Well, that was a TV broadcast that was highly biased. That was face-to-face with Connie Chung. That was in, I think, 1991. And she based that on three women's stories. Ironically, each of the three women had different symptoms. It was always difficult to pinpoint exactly what the silicone disease was. Ultimately, there were 200 different diseases attributed to silicone. My goodness, tobacco doesn't cause nearly that many, but at one time the media had it that that hundreds of diseases were all caused by silicone, and television reports like that certainly didn't help.
So what do we do differently in 2015 than we used to do that's better, or are we doing anything differently?
Well, I don't know what's better. I worry about science literacy in our population. Look at what's happened with immunizations. That's just absolutely tragic. So there's a lot of junk science out there. There's a lot of science illiteracy. I don't think this problem is going to get better until we improve science literacy, and that has to start in the schools, math and science. People have to be able to pick up a newspaper and read a story and say, well, now, let's see, did they deal with an entire population of people? Has there been a control to this study that's being reported, or is this just an isolated experience, or has it just occurred in a few laboratory mice and not in a human population. All of those things need to be considered before we have a more prudent public understanding.
You know, at first glance, you wouldn't think a book about a medical device would be that interesting. But your book is fascinating reading. What did you learn that surprised you while researching?
I was overwhelmed by the power that a single agency has on almost 25% of our GDP are items that are regulated by the FDA. I was shocked.
I have to say this. That's said by somebody who's a very sophisticated academic doctor. I mean, you know, you're a professor. You've been around medicine for a long time. And that you're shocked by that is pretty amazing to me.
Well, I'm shocked by how long it takes to approve even ordinary things. Let's set breast implants aside for a moment. My wife is diabetic. I happen to know about an amazing development called the bionic pancreas. A very sophisticated group back in Boston are working on it. And it's two pumps that are going to give medicines that affect blood glucose. It's going to be operated by a smartphone. There's no new physiology. There's no real new technology. It's just putting things together. And it's in its eighth year of review. And I heard this presented recently and asked how much longer before we have a commercial product. And they said, oh, it's going along quite well, another 2 or 3 years. Well, that's because they're accustomed here in America to that lengthy period of review. In Europe, it would have been reviewed much more quickly.
Does quick mean better?
Well, one way to test whether a fast review is bad is how many times you have to reverse your approval decision because of adverse circumstances. Western European nations have a review process that have no more reversals of approval than we have in this country. So they're doing something better. And we have models like Underwriters Laboratory. Look, Underwriters Laboratory is a private entity. They operate under strict guidelines, but they approve 10,000 items each and every year. And they do it relatively quickly, and they do it safely. So there are better models than what we've got now.
If you're a company trying to bring a new product to the market, you look back at the silicone debacle, if you will, and then you hear about your story about the bionic pancreas, and you think, 10 years, our company can't survive that long. We can't afford to do that. What kind of barrier does that present to innovation and new products coming out?
They have to be able to raise enough money, not only to develop the product, but also to get through the regulatory process. Tufts University monitors the approval of drugs. They're now estimating that it costs $1 billion to develop a new drug.
And who's going to end up paying for that?
Consumer. All costs are eventually transferred to the consumer.
And who paid for the cost of all the lawsuits against the silicone breast implants?
The consumer.
So yes. We all end up, it's sort of astonishing amounts of money that we could do a lot more with for other things, for good, if you will.
Absolutely.
So in the last few minutes, the world according to Jack Fisher, what would you like to see now? You've got the benefit of being the person who has analyzed this scenario that happened, the silicone on trial. You know what's happened better than anybody else. You lived through it, you were part of it, and now you've studied as a historian. What do you want to see going forward? What do you want to see change?
I don't know it better than anyone else. I'm just a student of the regulatory process. But let me tell you that for my book, I had sources from within the FDA, three former commissioners, a former general counsel, a deputy, a department head. I listen to them. They all have very good ideas about how the FDA could be reformed. So I would like some of their ideas to be put into action. That requires a Congress, and we all know that right now we don't have a Congress that seems to be able to make any decision at all.
So if a president calls you and says, we want you to chair a commission to revamp the FDA, you're going to say yes?
No, I'm going to say, why don't you go to some of the people who have worked within the FDA and have voiced very good proposals for improving the process? That's who ought to be doing this. They know more about regulation than I do. I'm critical of the agency overall and its record, but not necessarily some very important and very bright people who've worked for the FDA.
As scientists, politics and science don't always feel like they should be mixing.
Well, I think that when you are dealing with decisions that could be based on politics or science, and it involves a product that is based on technology, science should always prevail.
I think that's a great concept. And with that, I'm going to thank you for spending some time with us today. And more importantly, for all the work that you did putting this together, because those who don't learn the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them. We need to learn this lesson going forward.
Right.
So thank you. The power of science. We say it here all the time on Health Matters. Knowledge is power. You have to understand science. Listen to the people who are experts in it. And be very careful about some of what you hear and read in the newspaper. Be a critical reader. Be a critical ingester of information. Make sure you think while you read. It's the only way to get through this. This lesson we have learned from Dr. Fisher in Silicon on Trial is a very powerful and important one, and I hope everyone was listening carefully. I'm Dr. David Granite, and we'll see you again right here on Health Matters.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.